I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland?
Here.
Anderson?
Here.
Blaine? Ellison?
Here.
Fuller?
Here.
Hillstrom?
Here.
Hilty?
Here.
Johnson? Lesh?
Yeah.
Pittman?
Here.
Meslow?
Murphy? Here.
Tamar? Powell?
Here.
Rhodes?
Here.
Soderstrom? Strand?
Here.
Powell?
Wall?
Here.
Here.
Here. Chair notes that we do have a presence of a quorum, therefore we'll take up a consideration of the minutes from the March 23, 2004 meeting. They're in the packet. Representative Fuller moves approval of those minutes. There's no questions. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. At this point, before going into any of the bills, I'm going to ask Mr. Carger to briefly go through the green-sheeted spreadsheet that we have. If there's any specific questions that he could answer, then we'll take those. Otherwise, discussion will be saved until tomorrow on this spreadsheet. Mr. Carger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we will be working off the green spreadsheet. I should point out, too, that one item that is not covered in here is the .08 bill. That bill is running on its own, and I think what happened in transportation, they put the start date at point or 2007. So even with that, there would be nothing showing up on the spreadsheet if we had appropriations. And we may pick up that that bill, I think, after it, you know, for a conference committee. Mr. Chair, and then what I will do is I'll just cover the differences. We already went over what the governor's budget is, so I'll cover just the differences from the chair's recommendations compared to the governor's. First one is on page 1, line 3. This is civil legal services. There is a reduction in fiscal year 05 of $1.572 million. Line 8 is the Ramsey County surcharge. This is the $1 surcharge that for diversion programs for just Ramsey County. This will cost the first year $108,000, then goes to $118,000. There is revenue to come that comes in that will make this budget neutral or revenue neutral. Next item is line 9. This is the increased funding for the sex offender bill. This is Representative Zeller's bill, and the courts, this is the district courts now, they are getting $2.471 million in 05, and that then goes up to close to $5 million for TAILS for 06 and 07. The Board of Judicial Standards, same. Public Defense Board, line 19. This is the replace funding loss from the copay. The governor had a $7.681 million increase. The recommendations on this spreadsheet is a $3 million increase. Next, we go to line 23. Once again, this is the sex offender bill that we heard and had discussion on yesterday. This is the appropriation to the public defenders for 05. It is $1.537 million. And then with TAILS, the TAILS go up to a little over $3 million in 06 and in 07. Next agency is public safety. The first item with the difference is the hotel, motel, and resort inspections. The governor had a general fund appropriation of $283,000. He was also going to charge the resorts, the smaller resorts, a fee that was a little, it was about half what the other resorts are getting. So what the recommendations is that we just pick up that there are no, the law stays the same, but we are picking up the funding on that. So it's now $565,000 a year instead of the $283,000 a year. The next item is on line 35, sex offender registration for homeless. I believe this was Representative Strand's bill. There's a one-time appropriation of $100,000 to the BCA. Line 36, community notification for those moving into Minnesota. Another one-time cost of $100,000. Then on line 37, This is the crime victims funding increase. They had they changed their way of distributing grants. Some counties were losing up to 25%, or some judicial districts, I should say. This will lessen it so that no one takes more than a 12.5% reduction. And that is a one-time appropriation of $532,000. Page 2, human rights is the same. Corrections, we'll go through the differences there. That they begin on line 58. This is the bed savings. This was Representative Lippman's and Ellison's bill on the drug offenders. And also on line 59, the Corrections Parole Board, Representative Fuller's bill. What we're doing here on this, in the bill, there will be a study done on these two issues in sentencing guidelines, and we'll see that below. Next, we have the community on line 60, community notification, once again, for those offenders moving into Minnesota. Here's an appropriation for the Department of Corrections of $100,000 in 05, and with tails of $150,000 each year. Line 61, this is the increased funding for the sex offender bill. This is a lot of this is bed space or the bed impact and a few other things for corrections. That starts out with tails. It's $832,000, goes up to $2.159 million in fiscal year 07. Line 66, 67, sentencing guidelines. Sentencing guidelines will receive, according to this bill, $40,000 to do the study on the parole board and the indeterminate sentencing. Page 3, members, this is the, we'll start off with the revenue adjustments and some of the differences from the governor. Line 75 is the public defense copay. They are estimating that to take in $180,000 a year. That is in revenue. Next, we have what we talked about earlier, the Ramsey County surcharge of $1. That's estimated to bring in $100,009 the first year, then with tails of $124,000. Next, we should go to the, well, you can see then at on line 84, our target was $15,676,000. We meet that on line 82. Two other items, we have the on line 87, these are non-general fund statutory appropriations or accounts. The fire marshal, the governor had $282,000 from the fees. We are just putting that in as an appropriation. And the last one on line 88 is the 911 fee. The governor had a 10-cent increase on that to fund some deficiencies, and the chair's rec does not recommend that 10-cent increase.
Any questions at this time? Representative Paymar.
So did you say we're going to have discussion on this tomorrow? Or tomorrow?
Representative Paymar, yes. We'll take specific questions of Carter if they're not clear from the face of the document. Any discussion on the rationale or the reason for or against why the number is there will take tomorrow, not today.
And will there be people from legal aid and all the affected agencies available tomorrow? Because
Representative Paymar,
I have questions of Ms. Ellison on the crime victims change, and I have questions about the impact of the cuts to legal aid.
That's fine, Representative Paymar. If they're here today, I assume they'll be here tomorrow. If not, feel free to let us know who specifically you might want. If there's no other questions, then we're going to move along. Representative Kilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification. Amendments for this section of the bill are due by 6 p.m. tonight. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, let's move along to the first of three bills we're going to hear this morning, House File 2915. Representative Johnson, workers' compensation technical changes provided, definition of personal injury clarified, et cetera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hear a motion.
It would be nice to have a motion to send this to Government Operations, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 2095 be recommended to pass and move to the Committee on Government Operations.
Okay, that's the motion. Excuse me, before us. Representative Johnson, I see two witnesses, Hargarten and Hawley, listed. Are they witnesses of yours to help present?
Ms. Hargarten is. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the second name. I believe the second name is in opposition.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. Without opposition, let the record reflect the proper motion would reference House File 2915.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had noticed I moved the Westerberg bill by accident.
Well, let's deal with Mr. John, Representative.
Unless we want Westerberg to go first, and I'll
we'll
reference
proceed.
To.
Okay, your bill's
more worse. Interesting.
Bear in mind, we have two other bills, and we want to hear what you have to say, but also let's move along.
I'll keep it short, Mr. Chair. Essentially, House File 2915 is the recommendation of the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council for several changes in workers' comp law. As you probably all know, the council was created in 1992 as a permanent council on workers' compensation. It has 12 voting members. Half are appointed by labor. Half are appointed by business. It also has four non-voting legislative members. I believe it's two DFLers and two Republicans. And also sitting on the board, on the council, are the president of the chamber and the president of the AFL-CIO. The council advises the Commissioner of Labor and Industry on workers' compensation matters, and then every year makes recommendations for changes in the workers' comp laws. These are the recommendations for 2004. These recommendations only move forward out of the council, Mr. Chair, if they are approved by a majority of both the business representatives and the labor representatives. So I think it's fair to say that this is a very delicate political balance. There are pieces in here that one side does like and doesn't like, and vice versa. And if we pull any piece out or add something new, the whole bill essentially falls apart. So having said that, I would like to ask Ms. Hargarten from the Department of Labor and Industry to reference those portions of the bill that might be relevant to this committee.
Representative Johnson, just before we do that, I heard what you just stated, but this committee, as does any other committee, reserves the right and has the right to hear the bill and amend it to either add, delete, or modify any language in any bill before it. Isn't that correct?
Of course, Mr. Chair.
Okay. State your name and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Beth Hargarten, and I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Workers' Comp Division at the Department of Labor and Industry. I believe one of the provisions that Mr. Chairman thought the committee needed to pay particular close attention to is Section 2 of the bill, which starts on page 3. And this language confirms that injuries or diseases resulting from a vaccine that an employee has received in response to a declaration by the United States Department of Health and Human Services are considered to be arising out of and in the course of employment and therefore are compensable under the Minnesota Workers' Compensation Act. This is a provision that came to us from the Minnesota Nurses Association. And in the Health Committee, where this bill was heard previously, I believe Mr. Chairman had a couple of questions on this section regarding exclusive remedy provisions. Under Minnesota law, if an individual is injured in the course of their employment, their exclusive remedy against their employer is the workers' compensation system. They are not allowed to sue their employer directly unless their employer intentionally desired to hurt them. It's a pretty high standard in this state. The language that you see in Section 2, I do not believe alters that law at all. Currently, if a nurse was injured in the course of her employment as a result of administering a vaccine, the nurse's exclusive remedy would be against the employer through workers' compensation. The federal government in the Terrorism Act last year did provide another method for reimbursement of medical expenses and lost wage expenses for individuals that found themselves in this situation, but the CDC has told us that that reimbursement system is secondary to workers' comp. So workers' comp would be their primary source where they would find reimbursement for lost wage loss or medical benefits that were due. And the terrorism funding mechanism that they put in place in the federal government would be their secondary source. Mr. Chairman, if you'd like for me to move on, I think another section that there were some concerns on or wanted to pay particular close attention to was section 15 of the bill, which begins on the very bottom of page 18 and goes for a couple of pages. In particular, the language that I believe you might have some questions on is all the way at the end of section 15, which is found on page 23, beginning on line 6.
Well, Ms. Hargarten, back up to page 21. I believe this committee has purview to review the language on that, and it especially has my concern as a representative, language on that entire page, but specifically the last four or five lines, beginning on 34, where the compensation judge's order shall constitute a final order of the commissioner, not subject to further review. I presume that means not subject to judicial review. Would you address what that language says,
Mr. Chairman,
the rationale?
Mr. Chairman, members, this language mirrors language that is already currently in the workers' compensation law, and this is trying to get at those individuals that do not end up providing alternative benefits to the workers' compensation system. And yes, Mr. Chairman, this would be not subject to further review, which is consistent with language we already have in the law for employers that do not insure as they are required to do under the law. And Mr. Chairman, for your reference, the language that I'm talking about, it refers to, is currently found in 176.181, subdivision 3B.
And you had other language on page 23 you were going to address?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And this also mirrors language that is currently in the workers' compensation law. It is found in 176.178, subdivision 1. There currently is language in the law that addresses fraudulent behavior by an employer who fails to insure for workers' compensation insurance.
Anything else?
Not on that section, Mr. Chairman. Was there another portion of the bill that you'd like for me to review?
Oh, do you have anything else?
No, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I'm open for questions.
Any questions? Representative Strachan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick one, either for the representative or the witness. Can you, forgive my ignorance, can you just give me a quick, for instance, on a religious group that would not allow its members to take benefits?
Go ahead. Ms. Hargarten.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the language that we put in here in Section 15 mirrors language that the state of Wisconsin has, and it's primarily to address the Amish or Mennonite community. We have had a situation that's been going on with our agency for a number of years involving that community. That would most likely be the only religious entity that would meet the requirements of the law.
Any other questions? Thank you. We have two additional witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'm going to, in deference to all of our times scheduled in this late session, I'm going to rearrange the order. Mr. Carlson, you've asked to speak to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. We need to express some concerns about the bill. I understand it is from the Work Comp Advisory Committee. We by law, aren't represented on that committee. Attorneys are and people that represent the injured workers are not by law allowed on the Work Comp Advisory Council. I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing, but this is our first opportunity to address some of the concerns that we have with the bill. A number of them I've shared with Representative Johnson.
Hang on. It's a little loud in the audience. We can't hear.
Mr. Chairman and members, whether it's for judiciary policy or civil law, on page 3, lines 36, the new section that adds the provision relative to an employee taking a vaccine such as a smallpox vaccine does raise the question of remedies for us and exclusive remedies, and I think the witness from the department indicated our specific problem. The only time that you can escape outside of the comp system is when there is an intentional act by the employer. Forcing your employee to take a vaccine that injures them is indeed an intentional act, and we are now adding that into the exclusive remedy of the comp system. I'm not sure that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I raise that concern because it is not in the law right now, and so the question that we have, and possibly it's for civil law to address, is does that take away your right when you intentionally take the smallpox vaccine and you're forced to take that from your employer? Does this then now eliminate your ability to bring a separate cause of action for intentionally injuring you? And that's the question that we have that I don't believe has been answered in either of the two previous committees. Mr. Chairman, we also have additional concerns about the bill. On page 14, line 18, this allows the employer to contract with a managed care company for the specific purpose for dispute resolution that would be handled by the managed care company. And again, a question possibly for civil law is, I don't know if you have a remedy right now to have that dispute adjudicated by the work comp judges and then a subsequent appeal. It just raises the question as to what does that language mean. It hasn't been explained in any of the previous committees that we have been at. And so we do have a question about whether or not you're losing your right to have a hearing before a comp judge on those medical decisions that a managed care company may make. Mr. Chairman, going on further then, we do have some questions about Section 15 that Ms. Hargarten just referenced as it relates to the comp provisions for religious sex. Sorry. The question that we have, which I currently view differently than what the witness testified to, as it relates to a non-appealable order, we had always understood, this is on page 21, we had always understood that a final order was, that terminology was used so that you could obtain judicial review. As I understood the witness, she is reading that to mean that there would be no additional review, meaning there would be no judicial review of that comp judge's order. And I find an inconsistency in the law then where you would have a non-appealable comp judge order that is enforceable by way of civil contempt, which includes up to a $200 per day civil penalty and incarceration for the person who the court would find in contempt. We have problems with that concept, number one, as a non-appealable order, which includes incarceration. But further, as you read the bill, it's not identified who would be held in contempt, how they would purge themselves of the contempt, and I don't know that that's intentional. But I don't know if we're going to round up everybody, you know, in the sect that that potentially is responsible for their care. It just is unidentified. So you have a bill or a language that's written that would be almost unenforceable because you don't identify who, in fact, would be responsible for the activity. It says the religious sect, and it doesn't identify an individual person. And to purge yourself of contempt, you have to have 8 different specific criteria, including who's in contempt. I think this fails to meet that requirement. That identical language is picked up, Mr. Chairman and members, on page 23, lines 3 through 10, where you have a non-appealable order that is now subject to criminal sanctions, where you would have the court imposing criminal sanctions and they can't review the underlying merits of the comp judge order. And we find that to be inconsistent with law. At a minimum, if it is on line 5 not subject to further review, it should be at a minimum not subject to further administrative review and not judicial review. And finally, Mr. Chairman, on page 26, line 33, this is a provision that allows the commissioner to adopt outside of the normal rulemaking process payments and provisions for medical care under the work comp system. And it specifically excludes the commissioner from following the normal rulemaking process under Chapter 14.389 and excludes them from having to have any type of public hearing or notice, no matter how many providers or workers object to the rules as they would be promulgated by the commissioner. At a minimum, if we're going to grant this emergency rulemaking authority, which have the force and effect of law as soon as they are published in the state register, we should at least require that they be subjected to Chapter 14.389, Subdivision 5, which requires that if there are 100 people that object to the proposed rule as published in the state register, that the commissioner must order a public hearing on the issue and follow the rest of the Administrative Procedures Act. At a minimum, we think that that's important. You're talking about thousands of providers and potentially thousands of workers who may have their rights impacted by emergency rules that are not subject to legislative oversight or any oversight beyond the commissioner publishing them in the state register. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions. We appreciate the opportunity to be heard here. These issues have not been addressed in any other committee, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
Mr. Carlson, I think I have two questions specifically dealing with pages 21 and 23. And the notion that a compensation judge's order constitutes a final order and under this language is not subject to further review. A previous witness suggested that language is already in statute elsewhere. Would you comment on that?
Mr. Chairman and members, the concern I have is that it is in other language, but it is intended to get a final administrative action. It's a final order, and that allows you to exhaust your administrative remedies and then appeal. And that's why that language is in 161. It allows you to take the appeal because there is no other administrative remedy for you. What I heard the witness say is that this is intended so that there would be no further review, which means there would be no further judicial review or administrative review, and that's the concern that we have, that the judge couldn't even look at the underlying merits of the comp judge's order.
Mr. Carlson, on that specific point, if an amendment were offered and adopted to add the word administrative in two spots in this bill, specifically line 36 on page 21 after the word further, and again on page 23 on line 5 after the word further, would that fix that problem and allow judicial review of the administrative order?
Mr. Chairman and members, in my opinion, yes, that would solve the problem so that the court would have authority to review the underlying comp order, which is how 161 operates.
I think to move this along while it's still fresh in our mind, although while I'd prefer to take amendments after we have all testimony, the chair is going to offer an amendment to do just what I suggested, and that would be to add the word administrative on page 21 on line 36 after the word further, and on page 23 line 5 after the word further, add the word administrative of the author.
Mr. Chair, that's fine.
All right. Discussion. There's no discussion on that motion. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you. Any further questions of Mr. Carlson? I understand he has to go to elsewhere in the building on a different matter. Representative Paymar.
Well, I would like the chair to at least respond to this question about Section 2, Subdivision 16 on personal injury. While Mr. Carlson's still here, if
very
that's possible.
Very good. Can you handle that question?
Mr. Chair, I could handle that, but I'm going to ask Ms. Hargarten to come forward and see if she could handle it as well as I will.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm sorry, I was in back. I couldn't hear you.
Representative Paymar.
Well, I was just trying, would like a response to the point that Mr. Carlson raised about that personal injury does not include, and then it speaks to the an injury or disease resulting from a vaccine in response to the declaration by the Secretary of the United States, blah, 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 blah. This is out of the new emergency acts that we're putting into place this session.
Section 2?
I'm sorry, Section 2, Subdivision 16.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, Section 2 makes it perfectly clear that if an individual is injured or suffers ill effects as a result of taking, of being involved in these vaccines, that it is covered under workers' compensation law. The Nurses Association brought this to us. They were concerned that current law was not clear enough that indeed they would have workers' compensation insurance coverage. I believe the concern expressed before focused on there's nothing in this language that says that a nurse has to take this vaccine. If they are employed, and traditionally it's the emergency health, emergency room services, emergency response people that are going to be the ones that are getting this vaccine. There's nothing in this language that forces a nurse to get this vaccine, just as there's nothing in current law that forces a nurse to get this vaccine.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
I know one of the issues that Mr. Carlson raised was the question of whether this new language somehow eliminates a nurse's right to sue outside of workers' comp if there's intentional conduct. That's not my reading of it. It is Mr. Carlson's reading, and we would be happy to schedule a meeting and work through that to make sure that we're not doing something unintentional before civil law.
Okay. Further questions? Did you have a comment, Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman and members, as to the civil contempt matter and the administrative review, we did deal with the ability of the court to review the comp judge order, which we think is proper. It still does not address the question yet as to who is in contempt and how the courts would enforce that in any measurable way. And the eight elements of contempt and how you purge your contempt have been well established in Minnesota, and I don't see anything in this bill that identifies how that would ever be enforced. And for the person who may be seeking the medical care that is not being provided that you're attempting to enforce through contempt, I would think that you would want to have a clear and established a mechanism in place for obtaining the care that is not being provided. And the only other comment, Mr. Chairman, that I have would be relative to the section on relative to the emergency rules and making sure that that goes through some public process by adding language that 14.389 subdivision 5 must be employed so that there is at least an opportunity for public notice on what could be some significant changes for providers and workers.
You referenced the statute. Where would you put that reference to do what you're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, on page 26, line 34, after 14.389, I would add including 14.389 subdivision 5. So that it's clear that the commissioner must have to do that, that the section of public notice and an opportunity for hearing if it is requested.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, that's a fair criticism. We haven't looked at that. Would it be all right if I add that to my list prior to civil law to discuss with Mr. Carlson?
Once we look at subdivision. Add that to your list to do what?
To discuss with Mr. Carlson prior to civil law.
That's where you're headed back, correct?
We're going to government operations and then civil law.
Representative Lippman.
In my judgment, Mr. Chairman, and mindful that the next step is the Committee on Governmental Operations, rulemaking is within the ambit of that committee. I think changes to exempt rulemaking is really within the province of GovOps and is not a proper amendment for here. So I don't mind if he puts it on his list to talk, but I don't think it's a matter for this committee.
Well, before you suggested that, I was going to say without objection, I was going to let this pass, and you can take it on with your list of things to do.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members,
I trust both of you to
until I heard the motion that it was going to GovOp, where rulemaking is heard, I thought this may be our last opportunity past deadline to even address these issues, so
okay.
That's why I raise it.
Okay. At this juncture, anything further or any questions? Otherwise, we've got perhaps one other witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
All right. On the list, we have Judy Hawley, American Physical Therapy Association, and I'd like you to.
I think that might be better. We would have a more discreet.
You've been in the room, ma'am, and I know you've been listening, and you've seen the provisions we've been dealing with. We do not need to hear testimony on medical issues or issues that are not directly before us. So I would ask you to confine your testimony to the. Those topics that we have been discussing. If you can, give us your name and then go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Judy Hawley, and I'm a physical therapist and the executive director of the Minnesota chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association. I did have prepared comments related to Section 12, Subdivision 4B, but I won't go into those. I think I'll limit my comments to Section 21, Subdivision 5, and you can let me know if it's germane to this committee or not.
Go right ahead.
This section deletes statutory language that historically has served the work comp system well. We believe deleting this language may result in unintended consequences. We do not believe that this language has been carefully studied. We have not seen nor have we heard justification for these changes. And you all do have a copy of my testimony. We believe repealing the language, quote, based on accepted medical standards for quality health care, unquote, and replacing them with the words, quote, based on analysis of both medical evidence and accepted standards of medical practice, may actually reduce the level of health care that the courts have determined must be provided to achieve maximum rehabilitation of the injured worker. We do not think it is in the best interests of the employees or employers to make a quick change to this language. We urge the legislature to move cautiously in this area, and we believe this language needs further investigation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this witness? Thank you.
Do you want to move the pen?
Anyone else present who wants Representative Rhodes?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering, Representative Johnson, if you may want to go to civil law first and then have GovOps deal with that other part of it afterwards. But I don't know what your preference is.
Why don't you think about that when we get to the motion? We can amend it if you choose.
That's fine. I don't really have a preference, to be honest, so that would be fine.
I think it would be better to go to civil law first, Mr. Chairman.
I'll take the chairman's advice.
Okay. Anyone present who wants to be heard on this bill, raise your hand. I see no hands. We're back on the table. Motion. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, then, to amend my original motion with the wishes of the author and the committee, I would like to move that House File 2915 be recommended to pass, be referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Motion is before us. Discussion?
As amended.
As amended. Discussion? All right. Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess. All right, committee. I'm going to alter the schedule here. We're going to take Representative Westerberg first, and I'll give you the reason as you're getting to the table, Representative Westerberg, House File 29-2095. The request is made because his witness, frankly, has to get to the hospital by noon to take an EKG, and I think we better get you on and out of here as soon as we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is Westerberg in the audience?
Where is he?
Mr. Sexton went out there to get him.
He may be out in the hallway. We'll wait.
He's here. He's here, Mr. Chair. Coming down the stairs.
All right, House File 2095. What's the and where? Cheryl moved that the House File 2095 be recommended to pass, and on to the Representative Westerberg. Is the motion to Andy?
Yes, sir.
Is the bill to pass
and
to the
move
floor?
It to the floor?
All right,
yes,
that's
sir.
The motion. It's before us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2095 is a bill to prevent equity skimming. And under these schemes, a person whose house is in foreclosure is told that they or someone they know will either refinance their home so they can avoid the foreclosure, or they will buy their home and sell it back or lease it back to them, giving them an option to purchase it. The homeowner is told that this way they can remain in the home and avoid the loss of their property. What frequently happens is that the homeowner is kept on the string by promises that the financing is coming until it's too late for them to do anything other than sell the home to the equity to the mortgage consultant or allow the mortgage consultant to redeem the property from foreclosure. These transactions can be extremely complicated and confusing for the homeowner. And what we discovered is that the homeowner frequently misunderstands the fact that when the title is transferred, they have lost all of their interest and equity in the property. In addition, homeowners frequently don't understand that if they default on their lease with an option to buy or on the contract for deed payments, they will be evicted and lose all equity that they might have had in their originally had in their property. Now, this bill targets bad actors who are preying on people when they are the most vulnerable. This bill will do this through a couple of different means. One, by providing information to the homeowner and shining a light onto the transaction. And two, by creating financial incentives to help keep the original owner in their home. This bill will not put legitimate investors out of business or dry up the availability of capital for these types of transactions. What it will do is ensure that folks that have lost their homes retain a small portion of their equity. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Gary Levesser explain some of the options of the bill.
Okay, before we do that, committee, we're going to conclude both this bill and Representative Rhodes' bill by noon. So we have a time issue. We're going to deal with it as follows. Representative Westerberg and Representative Lippman, we're going to take up this bill and the amendments and discuss and do our action by a quarter to noon. So I guess I'd like you to focus on those issues that are before this committee or that you believe we should be looking at. We've read these the bill and the amendments. Also, I'd like your comment right away. Hopefully you've read the amendments, and I'd like a reaction to whether you accept them or not. Then we will go to the proponent of the amendments and testimony, take them up, and then get back to the bill.
Chairman, just briefly?
Representative
I will only be offering the 8:30.
8:30. Okay, good. So are there any other amendments that anyone chooses to offer other than the 8:30? Then focus on that, and I realize I don't want you to I want you to be fair to Representative Lippman, and he'll present it later, but I do need, since you're leaving, sir, I presume, let's have your discussion of it now, and let's move this thing along accordingly. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move very quickly. With regard to A30, we discussed this issue with Representative Lippman, and we are not opposed, based on our discussions, that he would like to delete the criminal penalties from this section, but would like to reinsert them.
at some later date when his concerns about constitutional issues have been addressed. So at this point, we're not opposed. The only other...
Did I hear you say that delete him now and add him back later? Where would you add him back?
Mr. Chairman.
You're going to delete him and add him back. Why delete him?
Mr. Chairman?
I don't understand. Somebody help me. Representative.
Chairman, if I might, briefly, I think that there are constitutional defects with the bill as written now and criminal penalties, and I can certainly explain why I think that. But if we were to change the text of the bill as how it, mainly the Commerce Committee issues on the floor, the criminal penalties might well again be constitutional. It's not a fix that I think we can probably do in Judiciary Finance, which would make the criminal penalties appropriate. I think we could permissibly do that on the floor, and I share their goal to define bad actors appropriately and to sanction them with criminal penalties. But my concern, and I can certainly go, I don't want to filibuster here, but I can certainly explain why I think it violates Article 1, Section 12, because we're criminalizing folks who can't pay their debts, you know, or there's a risk that it would be unconstitutional. So I think for purposes of today, to delete them, hopefully get a better fix on the House floor and reinsert them later is everyone's goal, but I'm just not sure we can take up Commerce Committee issues here in order to make the criminal penalties constitutional.
We have some representatives who asked to be recognized. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to express some concern about adding penalties in without it coming back to this committee. Clearly, any criminal penalties would need to come before this committee, and I would hope that we would talk about them.
Mr. Chairman, if you share Representative Hillstrom's concern, and it's a non-frivolous one, there's also a Rules Committee option, which is the Rules Committee could always report this bill after deadline to the House floor, and that would certainly be acceptable to me if you wanted to lay the bill over here or at some other stop.
Well, Representative Westerberg, I want to accommodate your wishes, but I also want to stay with the purpose of this committee, and that's to take a look at what you're suggesting you would agree to delete now and maybe add back later. If you want to do that, I would urge the committee to let you, but then you're going to need probably to come back here and let us take a look at this bill, regardless of how long that's going to take. Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We certainly understand Representative Lipman's concern, and we agree with it. There appears to be a problem here where, as sometimes it could work out to where a home in a failed situation would come down to a bottom line here where there could be money that's owed in the current calculation that would force a penalty or a fine on someone that we're not intending to have happen. And so we definitely want to work with Representative Lipman on this particular situation. Can we drop the penalty, please? No. Mr. Chair?
Just a minute.
Mr. Chair?
Well, I was just checking procedure. I don't know that I've... Go ahead, Representative.
Mr. Chair, we would accept Representative Lipman's amendment as a friendly amendment with the thought that it's not coming back to this committee. With the thought that it's not coming back to this committee, and we will deal with the criminal penalties in future legislation.
After this session?
Correct.
I was just checking the rules because it's possible that if you left this committee with this agreement this provision was deleted and then added later and our deadline was over and then we get the bill back, I think we might have a week notice provision to the world, so that would add some downtime we have to think of. But if you want to add this on as a friendly amendment, that might shorten up this hearing this morning considerably.
Well, I would like to do that.
Thank you. All right. Let's, Representative Tao.
Mr. Chair, as a co-author of the bill, the agreement was to accept the amendment and then worked on the House floor. I think the idea was to work in with the criminal penalty next session. I would be uncomfortable with that. I think if we do have an agreement to work on the House floor, then I would accept the amendment. But.
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm very much confused, and I understand Representative Lippman didn't want to talk too much about this, use too much of the committee's time, but I am at a loss for where in Section 4 the proposed language that's going to be affected by the amendment, what that has to do with someone potentially being jailed for having debt. All the language in those sections and subsections speaks about actions of bad actors.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Lippman.
To that point, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, there is a typographical error in the 830. It should be page 18 on line 4 rather than page 19. It's my intention to, on page 8, to delete the criminal penalties and on page 18 to delete the criminal penalties. So perhaps that adds some clarity.
Representative Lesh, I thought I understood what you were saying. You weren't very clear. Would you restate what you were asking or stating?
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, if in fact it is a typographical error, I'd like to look at this again and see if I do understand it based on that explanation. So I guess I would ask my question on another point, but I think in terms of this committee, there's the statement that this bill needs to be worked on based on some constitutional questions that I right now do not see in here. And we're set to move this on to work on those issues, and I don't see them. So I guess I'd like to be enlightened on that, but maybe the further discussion can help that out.
Representative Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, Article 1, Section 12 of our Minnesota's Bill of Rights states as follows. Imprisonment for debt, property exemption. No person shall be imprisoned for debt in this state, but this shall not prevent the legislature from providing for imprisonment or holding bail persons charged with fraud in contracting said debt. So, we've eliminated debtor's prison, but it's still constitutional to prescribe fraud. What my concern about the current bill is that if we had a refinancing transaction and property values were to decrease, no fraud involved, and property values were to decrease, if the equity purchaser, the person who is buying I guess the equity in the house and trying to reconvey it back to the homeowner, they're obliged under House File 2095 to guarantee that 85% of that equity goes back to the homeowner. If property values go down, there is a risk that that a equity purchaser would be presented with the following choice: either kick in some of your own money, because the value of the transaction is not enough to meet the 85% because property values have gone down. Kick in some of your own money or go to jail. I think that runs afoul of the debtor's prison protection, which is we don't send people to jail because they can't pay their debts. Moreover, in a generally bad down market, you could have equity purchasers who are involved in lots of deals that all go south. And the prospect that people are going to be going to jail for perfectly innocent conduct which wouldn't be unlawful if the market had gone up, is a real, indeed constitutional, problem and defect with the current bill. I think the definition of the 85% of what's to go back to the homeowner is properly a Commerce Committee question or, more generally, the Committee of the Whole on the House floor. But as it states right now, because of the way that 85% and that guarantee is described in the bill, a very noble objective, but I think technically infirm, we have a constitutional problem if you marry that 85% with a criminal penalty.
Representative Lash.
I guess it's my understanding that the Minnesota statutes, the Minnesota Criminal Code, is replete with provisions where we can send people to jail for making promises that their own bank accounts can't stand up to. And this strikes me as a similar situation, and I understand Representative Lippman's concern, but this to me is that same type of situation that I don't think has any more implications to Article 1, Section 12 than any of the, or many of the fraud provisions we already have in Minnesota statutes, and I think that's something that this committee should be able to deal with.
Representative Paymar, you had your hand.
Well, I would agree, and I think, Representative Westerberg, I think you really ought to think long and hard before you make this decision to accept this amendment, because you're basically gutting the bill. We're not talking about an individual who's helping someone out or purchasing the mortgage after a foreclosure. We're talking about companies here. We're talking about foreclosure purchasers, equity purchasers. These are businesses. If you don't have some kind of financial penalty involved, you know, what's the worth of the bill? You're essentially gutting it, and you know, maybe you'd have success on the House floor. I think we should work it out right here. And I'd ask that you withdraw your support for the amendment.
I'm going to make a suggestion and probably inquire of Mr. Carger. Representative Ellison, you are next on the list. If you'd let me go first, if that's all right.
No problem.
Thank you. I think we have a preliminary fiscal note that indicates this bill, in my opinion, as chair of this committee, should be re-referred to Ways and Means. I'm going to let Mr. Carger address that. My suggestion is, first of all, the amendment has not been offered. If the author of the proposed author of the amendment chooses to offer it, I'm going to suggest this committee reject the amendment and then move this bill to Ways and Means. And if you want further thought and action on this issue, you know, you have my best wishes in Ways and Means. But that would be my suggestion. Mr. Carger, am I right, or at least give us your information relative to my suggestion this go to Ways and Means?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I just pulled up a preliminary fiscal note from my office, and according to our agencies, there is no cost, although the courts have not signed off, but they said it will be a minimal impact, and it would not be. There's no felony provisions in here. However, the note does show $18,000 coming in revenue to the Attorney General's office. So it would have somewhat of a fiscal impact.
So I think what we need to do, also looking at the clock, I want to give some time here for additional testimony, but then I'm going to, if Representative Lippman wants to offer his amendment, we'll deal with that. I'm going to suggest it should be voted down, and then we proceed with the bill going to Ways and Means. At this point, Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, I was just informed that this may not be the fiscal note on your bill, so
it's a Senate version that has licensing in it.
Right. Yeah. Fiscal note I have is House File 2095-1E, and Representative Tao is the author supposedly on this fiscal note.
The witness.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kamer, we have worked a long time on this legislation, and we tried to come up with deterrence to this kind of behavior. And we started with establishing a civil action with punitive damages of at least 1.5% for foreclosure consultants and a minimum of 1.5% if the court deems appropriate for foreclosure purchasers. When we negotiated language with the Attorney General's office on foreclosure purchasers, they did not have a criminal penalty section in their proposal. And so that proposal originally came to the Commerce Department. I've been in so many committees on this bill. I really would like to see this bill move forward. And so I would just suggest that this bill gives a private cause of action to individuals, and it provides access to attorney's fees. The bill that's the companion bill on the Senate side does the same thing, except it, I think, also establishes a licensing system where folks who engage in these activities have to have a registration or licensure that can be taken away. So I think there are deterrents out there. The reason this bill is so important to us is we have focused on ensuring that people who get thrown out of their houses will get some money. And that's what the whole argument is about, how much money and should they be entitled to a certain amount of money. We still have that in the bill. Even with this amendment on criminal penalties, that language is still in the bill. And to us, that is the most important aspect, is that when people get thrown out and the transaction fails, at least they're going to get some portion of their equity. It won't be entirely stripped. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy, and then Ellison, and then I'll make a suggestion. Representative Murphy.
On that point, for Mr. Ambassador, you said that the people could take a private cause of action, but these people have already lost their house, got their house back, and so forth. They're not going to be able to find a lawyer for it. I don't see how this is going to work without with the amendment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the difference here is that the court is authorized to award attorney's fees. Right now, there's no assurance that there will be any attorney's fees, even if you prevail. Even if you had the money, or you had a relative who had the money to sue the equity stripper and you prevailed, there's no assurance. So what we're trying to do is establish some incentive for the private bar to take these cases. And by saying that if you prevail, you're entitled to damages, and you're entitled to attorney's fees, and you're entitled to punitive, potentially, if the court agrees, you're entitled to punitive damages, we think we've established a core incentive for the private bar to get into these and stop this kind of behavior.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ambassador, would that 82-year-old lady be able to prevail?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I don't know, because that case is sealed, so I don't have, I know that case was discussed in open testimony, but we don't have access to the complete file on that. So there was an argument about how much income she really had and didn't have, and there was conflicting testimony on that. But if she had $40,000 worth of equity and the potential to recover an unlimited amount of punitive damages because she had been defrauded, I would assume that an attorney would definitely look at that case and potentially take it.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, my question goes to the amendment. So I'm thinking that I'll reserve my comment for when and if it's offered. It might not be offered. Well, if it's not, then it wouldn't make a difference.
I am.
All right, let's do the following. Let's, at this time, suspend further presentation of witnesses. We'll go to the amendment. You can offer your amendment. We'll take 5 minutes for presentation, a few minutes for questions and discussion, then we'll vote on the amendment. And we'll get back to the bill. If there's time, we'll take additional testimony, and then we'll go forward. Representative Whitman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I would offer the A30 amendment and request to be heard on it. I share Representative Westerberg's noble goals and Mr. Levasseur's noble goal of trying to preserve equity for folks who have fallen behind on payments for their principal mortgage and need a little help staying in their house. That's a noble goal. It's a vital piece of consumer protection that I support and eager to get to that. The question, of course, is have we worded this bill, House File 2595, in ways that are constitutional and that ways that are sensible? Okay, so that we really are, as Representative Westerberg says, targeting bad actors, not putting out legitimate business people out of business, or drying up equity options for poor people. I think, as written, House File 2095 does all of those things. I think it does, you know, doesn't target bad actors well. It does put folks out of business who are legitimately operating and whom we, this committee and others, would want operating, and it does indeed dry up equity for poor folks. So I think we need to fix the methods about how we go about operations. But I do share Representative Westerberg's goal. I don't think it is, as Representative Paymar says, that these are big companies and not folks. And I would direct members to page 4, lines 3 to 5. It's a very broad definition of people who would be caught up under the ambit of the statute. Any individual, partnership, corporation, limited liability company, association, or any other group however organized. It's a pretty broad swath. So, I mean, the range of, given that the net has been cast so far as to be comprehensive, we have to be very careful about how we proceed. I think that there's a problem with the Constitution, as again, we've eliminated in the Bill of Rights debtor's prison, and if the transaction goes south, folks who are otherwise innocent and of good faith will go to jail unless they come up with money out of their own pocket so as to guarantee the 85%. If we're going to set prices, if government is going to set prices, we shouldn't send people to jail if they can't actually, for reasons which are not malicious, just of operating in the market, send people to jail for downturns in the economy. It's just wrong, and it's unconstitutional. There's also a problem with the comparison of House File 2095, as written, with the unlawful detainer statute. Under 504B.365, you can get all sorts of legal and carrying costs if somebody doesn't pay their rent and you have to evict them that are not recoverable if they don't pay their mortgage payments and one has to evict them. I don't think the distinction is sensible. I think it's going to operate, if we do have that distinction, in ways that will dry up credit options for poor people, and it's very undesirable. I disagree likewise with Representative Paymar's suggestion that my amendment in taking out criminal penalties either permanently or temporarily guts the bill. There are considerable penalties in House File 2095 absent the threat of jail time. You void the transaction if you do something impermissible, if you violate the statute here, which means, you know, the debt in favor of the equity purchaser, the person who would foreclose, is void. It's unenforceable. They lose the entire transaction. There are attorney's fees and a private attorney general statute so that folks from the private sector, like me in private life, can go and take these cases as if we were the attorney general. There's several civil penalties. There's also a exemplary damages provision so that you can get 150% of the transaction. So not only do we void the transaction and that they can't collect, we give 150% as a penalty for shame on you. And if they were truly bad actors, you know, that is a good policy. But there is pyramiding penalties for unlawful conflict or conduct. I don't think we also need to put a gross misdemeanor penalty. It's not necessary. It's piling on. And also a supersized fine. I think it's important members should know that while the ordinary gross misdemeanor fine is $3,000, House File 2095 has a $10,000 gross misdemeanor fine. So we've established a new category somewhere between gross misdemeanor and felony just for this kind of case. And ordinarily I wouldn't object, but if you're going to take ordinary investors who just had the misfortune of having the market go south, you know, we shouldn't send those people to jail or fine them in ways that are more harsh than ordinary gross misdemeanors. As drafted now, while nobly intended, the bill is unconstitutional, it's poor policy, it's bad for poor people. I urge members not to take, with respect, the chairman's suggestion and put on the 830 amendment.
Discussion on the amendment. Representative Towle, then Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would support Representative Lippman's amendment with the intention that we'll work on the an author's amendment on the floor. Representative Lash.
Mr. Chair, and just addressing a couple of things Representative Lippman stated, the statement of considerable penalties, I think, is just untrue when it comes down to how these individuals act. I went to the Commerce Committee hearing. I heard some of the statements made by the victims of these types of actions. Incidentally, the talk that we need to get rid of the bad actors and make sure that good actors out there can help people save their homes, I didn't see a lot of good actors testify. I saw people up there against whom allegations have been made that would rise to the level of fraud, extortion, and heck, maybe even some RICO charges. These individuals, if that is in fact true, are not thwarted by civil or monetary penalties. They're only thwarted by the fact that they're going to have to do some time up in Stillwater, or if it's a gross misdemeanor, down in the workhouse, and take some time out of their busy schedules to actually sit in a prison bed. And I think fundamentally that's the only thing that will make a big difference, is that kind of penalty in this bill. I have never before seen folks come before this committee, and we've not had any testifiers yet, looking to reduce crimes. We didn't see any sex offenders come before this committee when they had a sex offender bill up saying, please, don't punish me that much. We never saw any methamphetamine producers come before us saying, please reduce the methamphetamine penalties. I think, likewise, it's the purview of this committee to increase criminal penalties. I do not believe it is unconstitutional for the same reasons that any of those crimes that I had previously stated, neither are they unconstitutional. So I would urge members to vote against the amendment.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In response, Mr. Lesh, or Representative Lesh, I mean, I don't disagree with what you're saying, and I don't disagree with the concern that there should be penalties. I think I do agree with Representative Lippman that the category of potential people that are affected by this out there aren't people that are sitting around watching the legislature running in here to testify. They're small investors. They're people who are just making investments in real estate here and there and looking for opportunities to make those investments. And what we're going to do here is we're going to take a whole host of small investors that have no intent of committing a crime, that aren't out there, creating the victims that you heard testify in other committees, but they're just people that are out doing business and trying to make investments that can make them a profit. And to just, in a blanket fashion, include them in a bill like this, I think has some problems. And I agree with Representative Lippman. And I think the course that we need to take is we need to look at how we can make sure this is targeted at the offenders that we want to make sure are causing the problems. And this bill, it's not tight enough. It doesn't do that.
Representative Westerberg.
Mr. Chair, to that point, this bill is directed only to dealing with, first of all, foreclosed mortgages. And when those do, when that does happen, we're dealing with about 30% of that group. 70% of them are running to daylight. They're working out. This bill specifically is addressed only to the cases that fail. And I would like to call the...
No, we're not having any more testimony.
Okay.
We're going to go to Representative Hilty, then Fuller. Representative
Well, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to finish?
Yeah, thank you, sir. I'd just like to say that originally I was accepting that as a friendly amendment because the intent was we were going to be able to deal with it on the floor, and if that's not the case, then I would not accept it as a friendly amendment.
To that point, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fuller.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I think this discussion started happening with Representative Hillstrom's comments regarding these penalties and having this bill have to come back to this committee. If the criminal penalties were put back on in another committee or on the floor, I would say to this committee that we've had the discussion about them. There seems to be some agreement with the committee supporting the criminal penalties, but also having concerns with regard to the current unconstitutionality of the bill and some other issues that Representative Lippman and Westerberg are willing to work on and deal with on the floor. I would make the statement that if these penalties were taken out today and put back on the floor with the full understanding of this committee, that at that point this bill would not need to come back to this committee because we've heard the issue and could be dealt with on the floor if and when the agreement is made between Representative Lippman and Westerberg, that with the committee's knowledge, your knowledge of the criminal penalties, the understanding going forward, the amendment could be put on the floor, and we could move forward on this piece of legislation with, I think, agreement with everybody's comments that have been made today.
Representative Hilty, and then we'll see if we can vote on the amendment. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Fuller, I think that's just exactly backwards, with all due respect. The presumption in saying, well, we can let this bill go forward and we'll put these penalties back later, is that this is a problem in the bill that's capable of being dealt with. Well, if it's capable of being dealt with, the people that would like to deal with it have not at this point come up with any solution, and there isn't any particular reason to think that that would be forthcoming. So if it is a solvable problem, then I think we should let the bill go forward as it is without the amendment, and then the solution can be offered on the House floor, and if there is no solution, then we can vote the bill up or down. It doesn't make sense to me to take out what is, in my view at least, a vital part of the bill, saying that somehow it's magically going to get back in, because we know that there's a solution to this problem, although at this moment we don't know what it is. If there's a solution to the problem, let's hear it. I don't think it is a problem. And Mr. Chair, I would like to be able to remember how I voted on this, so I would ask for a roll call.
We'll see that you can remember, and so can everyone else. Thank you for the request. Representative Rhodes, your bill is next.
I know.
And so you want to speak now? Go right ahead.
Well, I think this is, Mr. Chairman and members, I think this is important. By the way, in my other life, I deal with people in foreclosure issues, and we counsel them to save them from losing their homes, and we have a huge success rate of getting people to work together. We're not dealing with those legitimate operators. We're dealing with a few people that don't quite, that prey on people, I guess, to be fair to say. I think what I'm hearing from people like Representative Lippman and discussing with him, and Representative Lesser, is like dealing with the Supreme Court here, but let me take it as a non-attorney. It seems to me that you need language, commerce type of language, to correct the issue so we can have the penalties in there. I think that's what I'm hearing. If that's the case and we can't get the commerce language put in today, what would be the harm of just letting it sit until you can come up with something while it still is in the possession of this committee? We're still meeting. And I don't know how the... Oh, I got a look from the chair. I better be careful.
I heard that we're still meeting, and you got my...
All right. So I thought maybe a suggestion would be to... I think the issue is we all agree that the criminal penalties are not the problem unless we get the language to agree that it will work, or we disagree that the language is needed. Would it be such a bad thing to wait a day to come up with language, or else, although we're not a commerce committee, that's the other tug, so I'll shut up at that point.
Well, the bill is before us today, and the amendment is before us now. A request has been made for a roll call. Hearing no further discussion on the amendment, the clerk will take the roll.
Chairman Smith?
No.
Representative Eastland?
Yes.
Anderson?
No.
Blaine?
No.
Yes. Ellison?
No.
Fuller?
Yes.
Hillstrom?
No.
Hilty?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Lesch?
No.
Lippman?
Yes.
Meslow? Murphy?
No.
Paymar?
No.
Powell?
Yes.
Rhodes?
Yes.
Soderstrom?
Yes.
Strand?
No.
Tau?
Yes.
Walls?
No.
There being 8 yeas and 11 noes, the motion does not pass. All right, we're back on the bill. Um, Representative Westerberg, do you have any more testimony?
No, unless the Attorney General's office has showed up. I was hoping to get a comment from them, but...
Let's do the following. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to be heard in opposition to this bill? We can give you about 3 minutes to come testify. Anyone in opposition to the bill? Have a seat, and I'm going to limit you to 3 minutes, and then we're going to discuss and vote on this bill.
I understand. Chairman Smith, representatives, I'm Corey Gordon. I'm an attorney in private practice. I represent RAND Financial Corporation. Just briefly, I might say that there was a misstatement. The case involving the 82-year-old woman is not sealed. The settlement agreement prohibits the 82-year-old woman, who was the plaintiff, from discussing it. It does not seal the case, and we would be more than happy to share with the members of this committee and the Commerce Department the entire contents of the file, the settlement agreement, and get the real facts before you, because there has been a lot of personal vilification based on, I'm sad to say, outright distortions. But more importantly, I want to address very simply, in the very limited time I have, a fundamental underlying assumption that pervades the discussion of this bill and pervades questions as to, well, how could a mortgage repurchaser ever lose money? How could a mortgage repurchaser ever be in a situation where they are unable to pay a debt through circumstances that don't involve fraud and are out of their control? The underlying assumption is that housing prices defy the laws of gravity, that housing prices always go up, and therefore that if you fix a fair market value of X percent or X dollars at the outset of the contract, that becomes a floor, and that at the end of the contract period, at the end or at the point in time where the homeowner is unable to continue the repurchase process and loses the home, that the value of the home will be at least whatever it was when the original contract was entered into. We have gotten into a mindset where we hear a lot of anecdotes about how housing prices always go up. Minnesota's never had a serious downturn. The data do not support those rosy scenarios. The data, the actual hard facts, demonstrate that there is a very real and cyclical risk of downturns, and it can vary from county to county in any given time frame. Let me just very briefly show you some charts that come from the Minnesota Department of Revenue. The data come from the Minnesota Department of Revenue. The charts themselves were prepared by Admin Minnesota. From 1984 to 1984, the 1984-85 to 1995-1996 time frame, a 10-year time frame, was a period of time described by Admin Minnesota as a period of sharp decline. And what I'm holding up is a map that shows this, the state of Minnesota, the 87 counties of the state of Minnesota. What my son has carefully colored in red are the counties that where the housing values decline. They decline from anywhere to just under 0% to as much as 40% during this time period. Statewide, the housing prices declined. In some counties in this time frame, there was a 40% decline. Now, there was a recovery of housing prices from the 89-90 to 95-96 period statewide. If you're looking at all, you know, just state gross state figures, you'll see that there was a slight upturn in housing prices during this five-year period. However, you'll see that there are still some counties in red. Those are counties, yes, that lost housing prices. The value of those prices declined. Well, okay, that was the 80s, those was the 90s, you know, now we're in the 21st century and housing prices don't ever fall, right? We just, you know, we're experiencing this wonderful boom. Anecdotally, right, you know, you put a house out on the market tomorrow and it'll sell for, you know, you'll get offers much higher than you ask for. We went through this unprecedented period of a housing boom, right, a couple years ago. What's the data from that, from just a one-year period, 2001 to 2002, just the last year before here. Again, statewide, housing prices rose. They rose overall about 11%. Some areas, great. They did great. The metro and the greater metro area did great. Counties in red, they lost. They went down. Kitson was flat, but that's why it shows up as red. Marshall County, 10.9%. This is in a one-year period. The boom times, right? Well, okay, I've heard comments made, so, you know, repurchasers won't do business in Marshall County. I guess if you knew for sure that, you know, well, I guess Wilkin keeps coming up, in red every time. So I think you can guarantee that no repurchaser will ever do business in Wilkin County. But you're talking about a law for all 87 counties. And, moreover, you can't predict which counties are going to go up. Cook actually went up during this period of sharp decline. When most of the rest of the state was going down, Cook went up. Most of the state's going up, Cook went down. You can't predict. It goes on a county-county by basis, and even within a county, much like a house next door to you can decline in value for reasons that are just completely beyond control. So the point of this, and I've rushed through this and spoken very fast, and I apologize for that, but the point of this is that if you look at the data, housing prices do go up, and they go down. And if you're going to set a guaranteed payment based on a fixed price at the outset of a transaction, and housing prices decline when the repurchaser goes to sell that, there is a very real possibility, particularly when you force the repurchaser to pay unlawful detainer costs, moving and storage costs, if the person refuses to leave and leaves their personal property there, the closing costs, the sales costs, all those costs come out of the pocket of the repurchaser under the current legislation. If the housing prices have declined, if you had written a repurchase contract in Marshall County a year ago, and the fair market value went down 11%, you're upside down. You have to take money out of your pocket. If your entire portfolio is wiped out and you're thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars in the red, and you don't pay and you don't have that money, you can't get blood out of a turnip. If you don't pay that under the current legislation, you go to jail. And I can't trump Representative Lippman's analysis of why that it violates Article 1, Section 12 of the Minnesota Constitution.
Mr. Gordon, thank you for your testimony. Our committee of the bill is before us. Representative Westerberg,
I just want to
closing. Go ahead.
Well, in two things. One, could I have the Attorney General's office that I notice are here speak to that fact in particular just briefly?
Yes.
And while they're coming down, I just want to point out that we've worked on this for hours. I mean, trying to figure out what's the best way to do the 85-15. I mean, this has been evenings and evenings and evenings. And I would believe that the approach that the other side wants us to take is that they want us to guarantee that they cannot lose any money on any of these transactions. But that's part of an investment. You do lose sometimes.
The bill is before us for discussion and closing. Therefore, I will consider their argument that it should take about a minute to help bring this bill, the pro, to a close. Thank you. Go ahead. Name and go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Julie Ralston Aoki. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Consumer Protection Division of the Attorney General's Office. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would just like to point out that the argument we just heard about the 85% and the market values going down, you know, this the way it's written now, it actually puts the risk on the homeowner. So if the market values go up, which is more typically the case that we have seen, they don't get the benefit of that. They are stuck with 85% of the value at the time the contract is made, and that's the most likely scenario. Now, if we're talking about fairness and changing that, then perhaps there should be then it should be truly fair, and the 85% value, base value should be changed whether the market goes up or down, so that that the risk is fairly allocated instead of limiting the homeowner's benefit and trying to maximize the benefit for the foreclosure purchaser. I just want to point that out.
Thank you for your testimony. This bill is before us for discussion.
Mr. Chairman, for a higher motion. Vote.
Representative Lippman.
I would move that House File 2095 be laid upon the table so that we can keep it within this committee, keep working on it. Clearly, there's a statement in favor of criminal penalties. I likewise support it, but until we can get ones that are constitutional, I would move that we lay House File 2095 on the table.
Okay, the motion to debate to lay on the table is not debatable. You do know that by doing that, this bill will be killed at this point.
We could send it to rules, Mr. Chairman.
On the motion to lay on the table, those in favor of laying on the table signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Does not prevail. Representative Westerberg,
Mr.
We're on the motion on the bill. Go ahead.
Just that point specifically about the criminal penalties, I'd like to have the Attorney General's office discuss that point.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ken Peterson, Deputy Attorney General. I'm not quite sure what the issue is on the constitutionality of the criminal provisions. Is that
correct?
If so, we did not see a constitutional problem there from what I was briefed on as coming in, but I'm not quite sure exactly what the issue is. But the quick discussion we had, we did not see a constitutional problem.
Okay, back on the bill. Further discussion. Representative Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, with respect to Representative Westerberg, one of the costs of doing business for folks who don't engage in fraud is not going to jail. But it is under House File 2095. One of the costs of doing business, if the market goes south, is that you go to jail. I think it's unconstitutional. It's defective. It needs work. We need criminal penalties for those who engage in fraud and who are engaged in malicious conduct, not just ordinary investors. I'm going to vote against this bill. I hope that a singing kumbaya and a group hug is in our future. I would like to vote for this on the House floor. In its present state, I cannot.
On the motion that House File 2095 be recommended to pass, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
House File 2304.
Mr. Chairman, do you want me to do it right from here real quick?
Yeah, it'd be helpful.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move the House File 2304 be recommended to pass to the House floor. And we have an amendment, which is the A2 amendment. And I'd like to amend the amendment, if it's okay with the chair.
House File 2304 is before us. The A2 amendment, was that mine?
Yes.
The A2 amendment is my amendment that I'd offer at this time. I understand the...
It's fine. The amendment is fine. I just need to add in the language that was part of the A1 amendment, of which won't apply, which is that includes a telephone number where the signing parent or guardian may be contacted during those hours. That's the Department of Public Safety wants that in there because the officers would need it.
Representative Rhodes, on your amendment,
it's
we
your
may
amendment.
Be going a little bit fast here. Tell us what the bill does.
Okay. I'm looking at the clock, Mr. Chairman.
I know. We're going to get through this by noon.
All right.
Basically, tell us what the bill does with the amendment.
What the bill does is basically it says that a provisional driver's license holder for during the first year may not operate a motor vehicle with more than one passenger under the age of 21 except for immediate family members or between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. unless accompanied by a parent, adult, guardian, provisional license holder carrying a written statement signed by a parent or guardian provision holder that authorizes them to do that. What we're doing is we're saying that what the amendment will do is we'll say that the parents can sign off with a note saying that it's okay for their child to be in the possession of the vehicle, and that's what it would be, but we need to have language in there that says that they have to have a phone number on there as well.
Representative Rhodes, you're in committee. The original bill is a graduated driver's license. Basically, if you're 16, you need your parents. You cannot operate the car between 5 and 8 a.m., midnight and 5 a.m., correct, Representative Rhodes?
That's correct.
Also,
for the first year.
Also, you couldn't have more than one other minor with you,
Mr.
in
Chairman,
the car.
Correct.
My amendment, and I talked to Representative Rhodes, in those cases, for example, where you've got a 16-year-old child who drives to school, and you've got a 15-year-old child, maybe another 15-year-old, who are having play practice or football practice, and the only way to get home, because mom and dad is not there or the bus is now gone, is to let the 16-year-old drive those two friends home. If the parents know about it, sign the note,
right,
give it to the child, and your amendment adds must-have telephone number.
That's basically, they have to have the telephone number where the signing parent or guardian may be contacted during the hours.
Just the question. In the event the parent is not at that phone because they've stepped out briefly, does that cause trouble?
I don't, Mr. Chairman, I can't imagine that it would. It's just...
Just more information.
More information, that's
all right. Does anyone... We have a procedure that we need to follow on the A1 amendment. Questions, Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the amendment, on line 4 of the amendment, it says page 1, line 24, delete everything after holder. But as I look at line 24, there is no holder in that line.
I think that should be line 25.
Line 25, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection, we'll
I think
note
you that. Drafted the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
It is my fault. All right, we're on the A1 amendment. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just clarification. So does this amendment exempt the person from having more than one passenger, or just simply the 5 a.m. to the midnight to 5 a.m. time slot?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, what this amendment does is it's saying that the parent can say that they can have their sibling or whatever in the car with them as long as they sign off saying it's permissible. So it's not only just the time frame, it's not in the time frame, it's just a passenger as well. So you're correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. So even if that person is not a sibling, so if it's maybe a group of people all going to play practice or swim practice or...
It would, Mr. Chairman, my understanding of the bill is basically what the amendment does, it says in the deletion, it's deleting that section. So the parent basically can, during the first year, this parent can override what this legislation does. I think, Mr. Chairman, that's what your aspect of it is as well, correct? That the parent can override what this bill
that's
is.
Correct. That's Representative Hamer.
What would prohibit someone from forging a note? I would have.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymer, we talked about that, actually. In fact, I have people from the AAA that would testify in favor of this bill, but in essence of time, we talked about that. What would be the difference when the original way the bill was written, that the kid could say, it's an emergency, I got to go get some Medicaid. In other words, it's the police officer is going to make the determination. If the note is forged, they can deal with that. If there is no note, they can deal with that. At least it gives us a chance of making a statement that we got to address the issue, and that is we got kids that are the first year of driving that are causing problems as far as injuries and deaths to other kids and other passengers, and we're trying to eliminate that, but we are trying to also make sure that parents, those that would like to take responsibility, are.
I can't wait till Representative Rukavina hears this on the House floor.
I don't think he's going to like this. But I'd like to save a child. That's what I'm after.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to sound like Representative Viskins at this point, I think. Isn't this about parenting, and isn't this about parents making the choices and being able to say to the kid, look, if you have more than one kid in your car, you're not going to have a car to drive? And isn't this just really starting to interfere in that relationship between parental responsibility and the child?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, all the great parents in the world do all the wonderful things. They aren't going to be the issue. The issue is going to be those that don't. And frankly, this was brought to me last year. We had a death of a student in Hopkins School District. I can go back to the times that I played for a prom, and the kids at the 1 o'clock in the morning drove home and drove up a tree and ended their lives. I think for all the tensions and all the safeguards in here, we still will be able to save somebody's kid from getting injured or a passenger being injured, and that's why we're supporting. That's why AAA is and other organizations, we want to see this succeed. And you'll get a chance to vote up or not. If you vote as you see fit. If you want to help save a life, fine. If you feel that all parents can do all wonderful things, that's fine. But I suspect in this committee we hear bills that parents don't do all wonderful things, and that's the problem.
All right, committee. House File 2304 previously was moved by Representative Rhodes. The chair has moved Amendment A2. I would like to insert on the A2 amendment on line 11 before the parentheses, the additional language from the A1 to read and includes a telephone number where the signing parent or guardian may be contacted during those hours. Representative Rhodes said
that's exactly right.
So the A2 amendment, as modified or as orally amended, is now before us. Discussion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
2304 as amended is before us.
I renew my motion that House File 2304 as amended be recommended pass to the House floor.
Any discussion?
And Representative Rukavina.
Representative
Eaton. So, I just have one question. So, like, if kids are at some kind of an extracurricular practice at school, and a friend or two ask them for a ride home, and they aren't carrying a permit, and what happens?
Mr. Chairman, Reverend, that and if they don't have a, if they do not, they're in the first year of their driving. That's also okay. What would happen if they don't have a note from their parent? They, if they say yes and they get stopped by the police or get involved, then they're in trouble.
Discussion. Any further discussion? If not, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Any further discussion? See y'all tomorrow. Meeting adjourned.